This message comes from NPR sponsor Hulu. Don't miss the new docuseries, Black Twitter, A People's History. From memes to movements, see how this powerful online community shapes culture and society. Black Twitter, A People's History is now streaming on Hulu.
From NPR, I'm Sam Sanders. It's been a minute. Today on the show, D.L. Hughley. He is a comedian and an actor and a radio host and a TV host and an author. Very, very busy man. I'm talking with D.L. this week because he's out with a new book. It is called How Not to Get Shot and Other Advice from White People. This book is a very satirical, very hilarious look at race relations today. Probably the most time spent in the book is on police-involved shootings of Black people. You know, but as timely as this story feels now, that topic, those themes about race and policing, it's been a thing that Black people have been dealing with and talking about since maybe forever. And even D.L. Hughley himself was talking about this stuff back in the day. I first got to know him as a comic. He was all over BET's Comic View, and he talked a lot about some of the same things in his book in this comedy special called Kings of Comedy. It is legendary. Spike Lee directed it. It's probably the only DVD that I still actually have in my possession. It's called Kings of Comedy. You probably want to check that out, too. Anyways, this chat with D.L. Hughley, we talk about race a lot. We use the N-word, unbleeped, just a warning for you all. We also talk about D.L.'s adult children. He has a son who has Asperger's, and he talks about that. And we get into Me Too. We get into Roseanne. We get into Bill Cosby. It's a lot, but it's good. And we get a little sneak peek of D.L. Hughley's new comedy special, which is going to be out on Netflix very, very soon. All right, let's get to it. Me and D.L. Hughley in our Culver City studios. So I guess my first question for you is, given that this is going to be an interview that is going to go onto the radio, got to point out, you're coming here after you just finished your radio show.
Right, I finished my radio show, the D.L. Hughley Show. It's an afternoon terrestrial radio show.
Yeah.
So it's really kind of all the same thing.
How many hours a day do you do it?
Four.
Lord God.
Four.
How do you do that?
Well, it's just the same thing. It's like, to me, whether you're writing a book or writing a stand-up special or doing a radio show or writing... it's the same source, different uses, like water to come into your house. Some you use to take a shower, some you wash clothes with, some you cook with, but same source, different use. So it's all based on my perspective and what's going on. So
what did you talk about today?
The young girl, Nia Wilson, who was killed in Oakland.
Yeah, that was crazy.
And then KTVU, Fox affiliate, used a picture of her holding... a gun holster, like, you know, the kids,
man.
And that was the picture that they used, and they juxtaposed that with the guy's picture, who had done a bid in prison. He had just got out, but he looked like he was going to a hostel.
Oh my goodness!
And she looked like she was going
to kill somebody.
Kill somebody.
So we should back up and say this is an 18-year-old
young girl. She was an 18-year-old
young girl
on a BART.
On the subway, and randomly, a white guy with a knife.
A deranged white guy
slit
her throat and stabbed her sister, calmly wiped his knife off, and walked away. And the station chose to use a picture that depicted her as really the more, you know, the more malicious.
Yeah.
And him as. And I think that is indicative of. It's really kind of one of the reasons. I've said this often, the most dangerous place for Black people is in white people's imagination.
That's in the book.
Because they make the monsters of us that they feel. Like, ever since our introduction to this country, they've been telling us who we were. They made a word up to describe us before they even knew us. Like, nigga, we couldn't have done all these things. Like, you were, but they have perpetuated an image of us that continues today that lets them kind of be, you know, as brutal as they want to be, because this is, they're maintaining society, and this is what has to happen.
Do you think it's getting better, this way that Black people live in certain people's white imaginations?
I don't think so. I think, obviously, economically, we've gotten better.
Yeah.
From a standpoint, but when you look at...
I see your earrings.
Huh?
Yeah. I see your earrings. You're doing good.
But when you look at the way that a kid can shoot up a school in Santa Fe High School in Texas, and he can get arrested. But a kid in Sacramento has a phone, and he gets shot. So that means that the dude who has a gun is less dangerous to you than the black dude who you imagine had one.
Well, and I want to get to all of that. Uh-huh. But first, got to ID and say, you talk about these themes all throughout your book.
Sure.
The book is called, I love this title, How Not to Get Shot and Other Advice from White People. It's this satire of race relations kind of in the age of Trump and Black Lives Matter, post-Obama. Right. But the frame is that you write it for black people, breaking down advice that white people have previously given to black people. Hilarity ensues.
About being black.
Yes.
About what they would do if they were black.
Exactly. Yes. And so, like, you have it all throughout here. Some absurd advice that white people would give to black people on, you know, how to, you know, not get shot. What was the most absurd bit of advice?
The most absurd, I guess the actual argument I had was with Geraldo Rivera, and he talked about Trayvon Martin. He said, well, if you dress like a thug, you'll get treated like a thug. Which in essence is the nation basically saying that this stereotype is okay.
Yeah.
And I think you look at these rash of people that are calling the police on black people for innocuous reasons, the idea, the very same people who are doing that, it's really no different than when any white guy could walk up to a free black man and ask him for his papers.
Mm.
It's the same thing, asking you, do you belong here? Like, I had a white guy, I lived in Calabasas, you know, 18 years. My house is paid for. I lived in Calabasas.
Yeah, this is Kardashian country. My house.
Right.
Yeah.
A guy, I've never seen you before. Well, I've never seen you before either, but my edict isn't to call the police on you.
Yeah.
Like, I don't greet you with suspicion because I don't know you.
It's a guy.
It's a guy. I don't go, well, because I don't know him, he is suspicious.
Yeah.
Like, Tim Scott, who, you know, he's a U.S.
Republican
senator.
Congressman. Right. Yeah, senator.
Senator. He's gotten the police. He talked about how he got the police his first year as a senator. He had the police pull him over 6 times in 1 year.
Wow.
And what does he have? A United States Congress, a senator.
Yeah.
What would he have that would be so outwardly suspicious that 6 people need to pull him over? Well,
even besides that, being pulled over, there were times when he was at the Capitol and they were like, are you sure you got to go in here?
Right.
When did you first have that moment where someone was like, you fit a description and you shouldn't be here? I remember when it happened to me first.
When did it happen to you first?
I was a band nerd all throughout school, and I was in marching band in high school, and it was either my freshman or sophomore year. My dad had dropped me off at band practice, but I forgot my saxophone. So I said, Dad, swing around, go back and get it for me, please, and I'll be waiting by the back door because you can drop it off quicker. While I'm waiting outside of the band hall at my high school, these cops roll up, and they were like, hey, what are you doing here? And I was like, oh, I'm just waiting, you know, for my dad to bring my saxophone. And they're like, well, there's some kids that fit the description that were trying to steal some stuff from the band thing and whatever. And I didn't think anything of it. I was young, but I said, no, I'm here. But about a day or two later, I was like, oh, it happened.
Right.
And then, of course, there's many other times that it's been happening since.
Right.
And you find certain ways to deal with it, right? Like you, in certain situations, you're going to have your hands where people can see. Well, if I'm in a grocery store, I want a bag for my groceries.
Yep.
You know, I want the receipt. There's little things. Anyways, when is your first time?
If I'm in a gym at a hotel working out and little white kids come in, I leave.
Really?
Because I'm like, I'm not about to have nobody say nothing. I mean, or if you find yourself trying to make excuse for you being who you are, or to signal to them that you're not, I'm not the bad guy.
Yeah,
right.
It happens to me a lot when I like see a little cute little infant, a little baby. I'm like, that's a cute baby.
Right.
And then some folks are like, who is this black man looking at my baby?
Right.
You know? And you see it in their eyes.
Right.
Anyway.
But the first time I grew up here, Los Angeles, 135th and Avalon.
Mm-hmm.
And, I grew up like a regular kid to the extent that you know what regular is.
Yeah. Now, what neighborhood would that be?
It was 135th and Avalon, so it would be the neighborhood where there were Bloods, and it was...
Okay.
I loved this neighborhood. I mean, my old man just passed, and we were all over, and I remembered how much it had given me.
Yeah.
So we're coming from getting some free lunch, you know, because in the summer they would give you free lunches, so the sheriff screech up. They tell us to come here, to put our hands on the car, and they ask about this older cat in our neighborhood, and they're, where is he? We're mm-hmm. looking for him. Mm-hmm. I'm like, I don't, we're just coming from lunch. I don't know.
Yeah.
So he said, keep your hands on the hood. And I said, officer, this is
hot. How old were you?
I was 8.
You were eight years old, and they had you with your hands on the hood of the car.
I said, officer, this is hot.
Yeah.
He said, nigga, if you take your hands off this car, I'm going to blow your head off. And I, in everything that I ever thought about crystallized at that moment. I remember going home talking to my mother and telling her what happened, and she called down to the station or whatever. Mm-hmm. But there was a look that she has that I think a lot of people of color have had with the interaction with their children, which is to say, I hoped I could protect you, but I couldn't.
Here it is.
And now I have to tell you know.
And you're only eight. There's always that moment when you're like when you see your parents.
Right.
They sink a little bit.
And I didn't really recognize it until, you know, later in action and seeing mm-hmm. all, like the most stark example was a kid in Chicago and the police pull up and they had this boy handcuffed and he pees on himself and everybody's out there. Mm-hmm. Then they let him go because it wasn't the guy that they thought.
Ugh.
He had the same experience I had 50 years and thousands of miles removed.
Yeah. You know, the premise of the book is breaking down white advice for black people.
Right.
When you were 8 and had that experience, or when you were growing up having those experiences, what were the white folks telling you?
Well, I didn't see. I had
you didn't
no,
see him.
I had no experience with them. I grew up
other than the police.
A very black. Okay. Every black person, every white person lived in my neighborhood was an insurance man, a policeman, or a teacher.
Okay.
Yeah, but I had teachers, but they could only I don't begrudge people their vantage point because it's intrinsically theirs. They, like one thing I came to realize, mm-hmm. I lived in Los Angeles my whole life, and I would watch game shows, and they would say, well, I live in Los Angeles, but I was like, not in my part of L.A.
Yeah.
One time I went to West L.A.
Okay.
By UCLA, and it said, now
Westwood.
Enter West L.A., and I went, this is...
That's that L.A.
And their policing is different than ours.
Can I tell you the story that I wasn't even thinking to tell you, but it is so indicative of how you're treated differently based on where you are. I don't bring it up too much. I'm not tooting my own horn, but I got my master's degree at Harvard, and I lived right in Harvard Square. Mm-hmm. And our first month of school, all the students are meeting, throwing a bunch of parties, and one group of students that lived in a big old group house, like 5 of them, had a big old house party. Everyone gets really drunk. Everyone gets really loud. The police officers are called, and we're like, oh, my goodness, like, the cops are here. I was past the age of, like, running out of the house. I don't do that, you know, because I don't want my back to them.
Right.
But I was there, and then they ended up arresting one of the guys in the house. I'm not going to name him, but he's Asian American. And I will never forget this. These white Cambridge PD police officers had that Asian dude arrested, and I talked him out of those handcuffs. It was unbelievable. And then I thought about that, and I was like, this is not Texas.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not Texas.
Nope.
It's not even Boston across the river.
No, it ain't Southie. It ain't damn like that. It's not that at all.
And, like, even now, like, I once the people in the neighborhood know you and you're in the nice neighborhood, you are like you can at a certain point become other than their character.
But except that those people move in and out.
Exactly.
And then you gotta
make it a point to let the new ones know.
The new ones know, and it's always so disconcerting. And you know, we're particularly telling about the story that you told. We're like I said, thousands of miles apart.
Mm-hmm.
Eons in terms of experiences. I didn't go to Harvard, but you know, and so
I barely went.
But how there are ways that your experiences taught you to be.
Oh yeah,
they are only informed by the fact that you're black.
Yeah,
like you knew.
Yeah.
What to say? It wasn't the white. You knew their language.
I knew how to deal with these officers.
That's right.
Yeah,
because you know what to say because you have been.
I've been there.
School. Like, I don't care who you are. You were going to Harvard. And your parents at some point told you that you were different. And at some point told you you would be treated differently.
They never wanted to give me the sex talk. They gave me the police talk,
that's
the black talk all the time.
Like, even if you could be a teenage, we ain't going to talk to you about sex, but we are going to talk.
Oh, yeah. I remember. And no shade on my parents. I love them both. They're amazing.
Right.
My dad was scared to do it at all. So he, like, outsourced the sex talk to my mom. And literally, it was two things. Don't date a white girl.
Absolutely.
And then don't have sex on marriage. That was the sex talk.
The funny thing about that is, even when they say don't date a white girl, it wasn't racism. It was that all our parents had that fear that you could be in a situation where her parents didn't like you, mm-hmm. or somebody saw you with her and didn't like you, or she could say that you had forced yourself. They live with this constant state of fear.
Yes.
They all have a story about a guy
yeah.
that got caught up in some
shit. Oh, yeah.
They all do.
All right, time for a break here. When we come back, how D.L. Hughley has talked to his own kids about race and the difference between that conversation with his son and with his daughters. BRB.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from ZipRecruiter. Hiring is challenging, but ZipRecruiter can make it simple, smart, and fast. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 job boards with one click. Then it scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. Try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/minute. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
I'm Ophira Eisenberg. Join me on NPR's Ask Me Another as we challenge contestants and celebrities to nerdy word games, music parodies, and ponderful trivia. Find us every week on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
There are going to be a lot of listeners to this show who are white and sure. say, I actually want to be active on this stuff. I actually want to help. I'm going to read this book. I want to be on the right side of this kind of disparity. What do you say to them?
We seem to be on the wrong side of history every 15 years. Like, you ever notice that? Like, we're on the wrong side. I think it's a simple equation. The very accountability that they laud and say that we should be we should have in our communities are the very ones we should hold apparatuses to. If a police officer kills someone, here's the thing that's very interesting, and it happens, plays itself all the time. Uh-huh. If I commit a crime mm-hmm. and it's caught on video, mm-hmm. all that the DA will do, a prosecutor will do, is play that video, turn to the jury, and go right here. If the same exact thing happens when somebody has a uniform on and they're in a position of authority, they'll go, we don't know what happened before this. We don't know his frame of mind. We don't know the state he was in.
Mm-hmm. What are the mitigating circumstances, et cetera?
Right. So I think it's okay to be, I think accountability is a great word if it works both ways. And it's if you see something, it probably is that.
What about the white folks hearing you now that want to do better?
Then they have to hold people accountable. I mean, they're gonna sit on juries. They're gonna have social media mentions. They're going to be a part of a community. So it's just not enough to want to do better. It's to be active about it.
I want to go back to your family. Uh-huh. How old are your children, and what are you telling them about this stuff?
My oldest daughter is 30. She'll be 31. She's 30. Mm-hmm. My son is 29. My youngest daughter is 27.
When they were kids,
yeah.
Walk me through the talk that you had with them.
Well, you know, obviously for your girls it's a little bit different for your boys, but how different? But B, you know, naively, I just thought that they wouldn't find themselves in the same situation. Well, my son is autistic; he has Asperger's syndrome, which
that's an added layer of
So that was
confusion
always,
for police officers.
Yeah, and so I just was very careful, one, because one of the things you got to do with somebody with Asperger's syndrome is kind of repeat the things over and over again. So maybe it was part that, but part of it, I said, I know you don't understand everything they're saying to you. So what I know to be true, I've never seen anything good out of a black man talking to the police too much. I've never seen a good thing. I've never seen a good thing come from talking too much. So at a certain point,
You
answer the questions you can, and then say, I don't want to be disrespectful. I'm not going to speak anymore. Call my parents, and they'll bring a lawyer down here.
Did he ever get caught up in a situation?
Yes, he did, and he told them the exact same thing that I told him to, and they let him go.
Really?
Yeah.
What did they stop him for?
Just coming from a party in Hollywood, and he matched the description, and they got to asking him all these questions, and where he come from, and... You know, and I gave him his name, his ID, and then they started asking questions. He said, I'm not trying to be disrespectful. I know you have a job to do, but I've answered the questions to my best of my ability. Call my parents.
When they called you, did you answer the phone?
They didn't call. They let him go.
Oh, before they even called.
Yeah.
Because my next question would be like, as a black parent, when you get a call saying this is the police department, I can't even imagine what that feels like.
Well, I've had it with my daughters who turned out to have some.
Uh-oh, what'd they do?
My two daughters, I don't know what tell their business. But suffice it to say, they were the criminals. He was the good guy.
How was your talk for them different? Naively, it wasn't the same.
Well, yeah, just be careful and be respectful, and because there was always this notion that they wouldn't deem them the threat that they was with him. So I probably was a little bit negligent in talking to them about it, because I just never...
Do you think society sees black women as less of a threat?
I think that black women appeal to them in a different way, and they maybe have a fear of them, but it's not as innate, not as primal as it is with black men. Like, in one of the things, one of the next books I want to write is How to Find Your Smile, because if you look at black men through generations, we're never smiling. And one of the things they talk about black men that they like, one of the things they like in black men, like the greatest black men, if you talk about Magic Johnson, what is you talk about?
His smile.
If you talk about he's so fun to be around, all the black men that society's embraced had a way of making society feel welcome and comfortable.
I've been trying this new thing now in life, like just to see what would happen if I didn't smile.
Yeah.
And in some situations,
prisons happen. You don't need to see what happens. I'll tell you what happens in the experience. Locked up abroad. That's what happens. But it is. If you go back in your history, your family, and look at the litany of black men standing together, not smiling. Why is that? Who stole your smile? And it's because from the time we've been here, we have been told who we were.
Yeah.
And so all the time that we're here, we're playing either I don't want people to think I'm this or I don't want people to think I'm that.
Yeah. Or I'm not going to show you anything behind
this
poker face.
That's right.
You're not going to know what's going on here.
So it's really interesting and very funny to me.
So then with all of that, seeing the factors that black women are facing and black men are facing, as someone who is married to a black woman.
Yeah. Even my mistresses have been black. I want you to say that. They all have.
Like I wasn't going to bring it up, but okay.
Even my mistress has been back.
What do you, and you've talked about working on your marriage and getting past fidelity issues, but like, you cheated, then you didn't cheat. What's going on?
I never felt guilty about having other women.
How long have you been married?
32 years. I just didn't. And I don't know that there was an old line in a movie, Carlito's Way, and he said, I didn't rehabilitate, I ran out of wind. But I don't. There are ways that I see things, and the way that I interpret things, I don't feel. I feel bad about the things that I've left in my wake, and like my daughter said, both my daughters have said, I want a man who's just like you and nothing like you. At the same time.
How does that feel to hear?
That feels, I guess it feels good and bad. I mean, I guess it's sweet and sour. So. But I don't feel as if that is all I am.
Yeah.
And I don't let myself off the hook for it. I understand I've caused pain, but I know that I love my woman. I love my family, and I'm a flawed individual who at least gives them the courtesy of not pretending to be something I'm not.
She forgave you, I'm guessing.
Forgave me a lot of times.
When did it stop?
It's like what do you say those drug?
Always an addict.
What is it? One day at a time.
Okay.
One day at a time type thing. Yeah.
But you feel good about where it is right now.
I do.
For you.
I feel good. Yeah. Well, you know, feeling good for me is never as like I hear people say things like that. I don't know that I feel good as much as I know that I feel clear. I feel. Yeah. Maybe. We'll see.
Also, the thing about feeling good, it's like there's probably something going to piss you off at least once a day.
Sure.
It's okay to be pissed off. I think there is a certain ethos in like the self-care, self-help mentality that I see so prevalent today. Like you should always find a way to always be happy.
Nah. And it's, you know what? It's so prevalent because my father, I lost my old man last Saturday.
Oh my
and
God,
everybody
so
was telling me, you got to be there, like my wife and my sisters, and you got to be there. He'll know you're there. He wants you to be there, in the service. Being there with him at, you know, I'm talking about as he is dying.
What did he have?
He had stage 4 lung cancer. And so as he was laying, first off, two things I found remarkable. It was, one is the best conversations I've ever had with my father were once he couldn't talk.
Me too.
like all we had to do to have a great relationship is for you to shut up. I just hate that it was cancer.
Yeah.
But so, you know, Like when he was lucid, he said things, and when I was, but when I got home from the gig from the road on Saturday, and my old lady calls and she goes, your sister just called. Your father's death is imminent. He's in L.A. So okay. I vacillate back and forth, but I don't want to go. So I go. I see this man who's my hero, fighting for breath. And that cough, and the way their eyes are half open and they can't hear you. Yeah. And I'm like, so I remember at one point I said, hey, old man, I'm here. Open your eyes. And I was angry with him, like he was, because he's such a formidable. I just didn't believe that he couldn't summon the will up.
Yeah.
So at one point, he raises his hand and it brushes against my face and it falls down. And I know that it was a muscle spasm, but they believe
it was. What do you choose to believe? Because there's a lot of stuff that happened when my dad was dying. I was like, that meant something more.
I choose to believe the truth.
Yeah.
And the truth was, he was a wonderful human being who died of a horrible disease.
Yeah.
Who would be he would be angry if he knew I saw it.
He saw him suffer like that.
It was just, when he died, my mother rested, so it was hours of this. And then you have the hospice care nurse who, you know, is as sensitive as you can be, knowing that you got another shift of this tomorrow.
Yeah.
So she's there, and they're there, and they're trying to, the oxygen, he's struggling to breathe. And my mother, she says, he's going. So we all rush in, and I'm holding his hand, and he takes his deep breath, and he never lets it out, and then his pulse just flutters and stops.
So you were there in the moment.
And I went, my wife and sisters went, this was beautiful. He went the way, and I went, this is the most horrible thing I've ever seen in my life, and I wish I had listened to me instead of them, because their version of what needs to happen and happiness and what's complete is so much different than what I have nightmares about it every now. I know it's just been a week and a half, but I have nightmares about it every time.
Oh.
And I talked to a really great comic over the weekend that was giving me a hard time, and he said that he'd gone through the same thing and he still has those nightmares. I'm like, that wasn't worth it to me.
Yeah,
it wasn't.
Yeah.
So people's notion of what happiness is and what, you know, being complete is so much different than mine. I would rather be clear. And it was clear I loved him. It was clear he loved me.
Yeah.
And the last time I saw him was 3 weeks before he died. And I'm talking about, even though I had been in his presence physically, he wasn't there for 3 weeks. It was just medicine and technology.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that was a long, convoluted way of saying that, you know, happiness and complete and all that kind of stuff is so much different for people. And it doesn't serve me like the people.
Yep.
It's not billed as advertised, I'll say that.
Okay. I did this thing where, like, so my dad died when I was 18.
Ugh.
And, like, bit by bit, month by month, I would begin to look back over our childhood and see all of the things he was doing for my brother and I that I didn't even notice. And I think I realized finally a few years after he was gone that, like, being a black father is so much harder than any black child will know.
Right.
Until their father. Is there a moment that you've seen in the last week looking back on his life where you said,
You know, I just never, to me, he was one of those cats that never smiled. And he was a guy who, I remember I was, it's so funny that you mentioned this, because this is the first time in a week and a half that I've thought of an image that didn't revolve him, so I was a kid, and I was on this guy's grass in our neighborhood, and I was sitting with his granddaughter. We were on her grass. He staggers out. He's drunk. He has a gun in his gun in his belt. He waves a pistol. Stay off my grass. The neighborhood kids can write to tell my father. So they run down there and they tell my father that this man had pulled a gun on me. And and my father gets up out of his chair. And I am grabbing his leg. No, he didn't. Please, he didn't. He didn't do it. Please.
Yeah. Yeah.
Please. And he drags me literally.
Wow.
And he walks up to the man. He said, you put a gun on this one? He didn't. He was talking to And he, you know.
How many of y'all were there?
It was four of us. But he went, this one right here. And he goes, and the dude was incoherent. And he pulls the pistol out, and he slaps that man with that pistol.
Wait, your dad took that man's pistol, slapped that man in his face with that pistol.
That man. and threw it on the grass and said, come on. From that moment on, I never had a superhero.
Huh.
I didn't. Everybody else thought Batman was a I thought that man was.
Yeah.
I've never to date, and I've been in the presence of men who I've never to date seen a man as formidable as he was.
My thing with my dad that I noticed more the older I get, like he would do this thing that my brother and I would make fun of all the time growing up. He would be perfectly happy sitting alone in a quiet room. Wide awake, just sitting there.
Yep.
And we were like, what the hell is wrong with you, man? Like, he loved to watch TV, but some days he would just sit. I'm like, what's going on? What are you doing? And now I'm like, he was zen. He had it figured out. Like, he had this level of peace with himself and the world that, like, I'll probably never get to. And
you might, man.
I hope so.
You know, it may not look like... You know what's so funny? I remember my father doing the same thing.
Really?
And I asked him, why are you sitting by yourself? Like, he would always be sitting in his van.
Yeah.
Or always be sitting off by himself.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, this is as close as that dude is ever going to come to having a vacation. Like, literally. Like, that's the best it gets for him.
That's it. All right, time for one more break. On the other side, DL talks Me Too and Roseanne, and his answers on both topics will most likely surprise you. Be right back.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Homes.com. When you're home shopping as a parent, you have lots of questions about local schools. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by a dedicated in-house research team. It's also you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
I'm Ann Powers from NPR Music. Last summer, we launched Turning the Tables, a project that radically changed how we talk about the history of popular music, with a list of the 150 greatest albums by women. This week, we're launching Season 2, looking at the 200 greatest songs by 21st century women. Check out who made the list and who didn't at n.pr/turningthetables.
I can't have you in this room and not talk with you about your comedy.
Mm-hmm.
I was watching you on Comic View back in the day.
Yeah.
I was watching you on Kings of Comedy back in the day. Still, in my opinion, the best comedy special of all time. I'm not just saying that. I mean it.
Thank you, man.
You in that yellow suit.
Oh, yeah.
Did it.
That was a...
Do you still have the suit?
Yes.
Where's the suit?
Yes, I keep hoping that Hollywood, Planet Hollywood, gonna ask for it. Like, I hope it ends up in some, like, somebody, like, asks for it. Yes, I still have the suit in plastic, ready to go.
Stop it.
And I can't fit it. It's too big.
It's too big.
It is. It is.
Describe this suit for folks that haven't seen it.
It was a yellow mustard wide suit. All you have to do is look at the Steve Harvey collection. That's the suit. Just in mustard yellow.
There is this scene where you're talking about the difference between white people and black people. And I watched it yesterday, and I said, this could be a line in this book today.
Mm-hmm.
I'm gonna play it.
White folk do for excitement. We don't do. I always got to ski and bungee jump and skydive. Black folk ain't gonna never bungee jump. That's too much like lynching for us. So I'm gonna let you tie a rope around me and push me off a bridge? You must be out your mind. Let me do you, I do you. That. We don't have to do for excitement. It's hard enough just to be black. All that. We have enough excitement in our life trying to do regular shit. They talk to you at work. What are you going to do for excitement today? I'm going to drive past the police and try not to get my ass whooped. And then I'm going to fill out this loan application that's been denied 50 times. And then I'm going to pull my wallet out and hope I don't get shot 41 times. That's what I'm going to do.
The same stuff that was resonating then.
Yeah.
Is an issue for all of us now.
Yeah, it never, you know, now it's it. When I think about it, I'd always wanted to, I think I've always had the same sentiment, you know, the same mentality or the same sentiments. Yeah. I always felt the same way. I think society wasn't tuned to that frequency now. And now, you know, they're kind of more tuned to that frequency. And
explain.
I think it's a lot of things. I think now they're more inclined to at least pretend like they care. You know,
they being
the society in general. Like, you have, you know, the social media movements, and, you know, everything's a hashtag, and people are woke, and now you know the metrics, the frequency wasn't tuned to that. People were just in a different place.
Comedy has changed so much. I was thinking about that special and how I consumed it and how I watched it. What was it, like a two-hour special with four comics that I had a DVD? Netflix has changed everything. Streaming has changed everything. As someone who is an OG of the game, watching the comedic, the comedy landscape now, how different is it for you?
Well, you know what's funny? I just shot a Netflix special May 11th, so it'll be out in September.
Okay.
But it just comes on. So it's just, there's no, like, it's just, the air date. Like,
what's it called? Because you have
to look at book
titles.
It's called Contrarian.
No, you need to have a title like one of these.
No, it's,
like,
yeah, because, you know, because it's comedy specials, though. Like, I've always had, I've done 11 of them, but they always had the one name. But to your point, it is all about people having what they want when they want it. And how do you, and that's a very cluttered environment.
It's so cluttered.
How do you, but I feel bad for entertainers, period, because now it's so much more communal than it would have been. Like, my manager can weigh in. I'm not talking about me. If I pay you, you're going to do, like.
You can do what I say.
or shut up about not doing what I say. But, you know, the audiences train the entertainers. It's like almost like this. All of a sudden, we start painting portraits instead of painting what we painted. Now people want portraits. Now it's like telling Michelangelo, "I want you to paint my family portrait."
And so you're saying that this collective social media buzz informs the art that you can make.
That's right.
And I also think that a lot of consumers of media, myself included, we want to go to stuff to be affirmed and not to be challenged.
Right. The definition of art is challenge.
Yeah. What is there a thing that you felt like you couldn't go into your new special given the current climate?
I will tell you this. Okay. That there is a conversation that because Netflix is kind of the new frontier. It's kind of the way.
It's scary.
It really is concerned. Like, it's Amazon. It's all those. It's all. But there's a bit that they didn't tell me not to do.
Okay.
But they said, you know, last time we did this kind of thing, the guy, you know, it was, you know, he said something like this, and this was.
Can you give me the topic?
It was about my son and his diagnosis and how I dealt with it.
Okay. And so you were joking,
like,
about Asperger's.
Yeah, they were like, can we get him to sign a waiver? I'm like, he lived with me for free. That's the waiver.
They asked your son.
Yeah. Like, they asked me, could I get my son? I'm like, but, you know, it was a little more to it than that. But ultimately, everybody wants to be safe.
That's the thing.
And we can't guarantee you that. If you want to be safe, ride a roller coaster, and even that isn't safe. Yeah.
Well, and also, I think that we are performing a certain performative safety that lets us feel like we've done something when the big stuff we haven't figured out
yet. Of course not.
And if someone can say, I did my woke thing for the day by tweeting to DL saying that joke was wrong,
right,
you can feel like you've done something. Right. But your son is still going to go out and get shot by the police.
Just like Roseanne. I didn't think Roseanne should have been fired because I didn't think she should have been hired. But ABC
explained,
is so...
Didn't
like,
hire.
I thought that she... Everybody knew who she was. Everybody knew what she did. I like Roseanne personally. I think she's
a talented... Is she cool?
You
hung out with her.
I make allowances for people who are talented that are in my kind of...
Okay.
They're in my get down that I can, you know...
So you're saying that you and Roseanne back in the green room, you'll be nice with
it. She makes me laugh, and it's not... I don't feel a sense of animus, but I do very much believe she's a racist, and I do believe that was... There was no... You know, like when she says, I didn't know she was white. Well, you knew that Susan Rice was black, and you called her a gorilla in 2013. And ABC, we didn't know. Well, you did know. You wanted her audience. And you did the same thing with Rush Limbaugh and that audience. You want to get the luxury of appealing to a certain mindset, but then pretending like you didn't know what they were doing. Rush Limbaugh did exactly what he was going to do, which was be racist, and Roseanne did exactly what she was going to do, which was be racist.
But you still say that she should not have been fired?
I think once you made the decision to take that on that mantle, you go for the whole ride.
As an ABC should just say, we banked on this, we knew what she was.
You knew what she was, you just hoped. I don't even know what you hoped. You knew what would happen.
Yeah, yeah.
That's why you put her on when you did.
Because I knew that this was a time in which
that's what they put her on. That's all strategic. You can't tell me that happens by accident.
Has there been anyone that has been pushed out of the conversation, lost a job because of controversial comments recently, and you said that was wrong?
I think that this whole Me Too movement, I think that we're lumping them all together. I think that they're all the same conversation. I think that you can't have a serious conversation about a movement that's going to bring people to heel or to justice when you have two men, one black, one white, they both work for NBC, they both were accused by dozens of women of sexual assault. Now, the black one's in the big house and the white was in the White House, and yet you want me to have a serious conversation.
You're talking about Bill Cosby.
You'll go back in time and re-adjudicate a thing based on 25 years ago, you getting judged. And how far are we going back? Are we going back as far as Thomas Jefferson? Because if you think that Harvey Weinstein was bad.
Hearing you talk about it, it seems as if there's an environment in which you think that, like, allegations could come for everybody at some point. Do you think they come from?
Of course. Well, I wouldn't be shocked. Here's what I'll tell you, that I am not unaware of who I've been and the things I've done. I would like to put myself in this. I would like to believe that there's nothing I've done that would border illegality. But I'm not in somebody else's position, and yeah. I know.
Well, and also for lots of folks, the threshold is not legal.
Right.
It's appropriateness.
Right. And I've done a ton of inappropriate stuff. But I'll say this, that I feel as if somebody committed a murder in front of you, somebody did something heinous to your family in front of you. You would, as the only witness, have to take the stand and say, even though this horrible human being did this in front of you and it's bringing up all kind of memories, I gotta face my accuser and say I did this. I think the standard is different. I think that you shouldn't be able to make an allegation unless you're willing to take the other step and say those allegations out loud and to do it, which is what I definitely commend the young lady who went in front of Cosby. Now, whether people like that or not, I think she did what you are supposed to do when somebody is wrong. You face your accuser and say, hey, this, you did it.
Do you think that men in positions of power like yourself have a greater responsibility now to say, when we see that stuff, to say, hold on?
I think we can assign whatever label we'd like. Power means my ability to influence your life in some kind of way. So having celebrity and influence is probably more appropriate. But I think that men are doing what they've always done, which is, and I think that it's the reason you'll see. How did Harvey Weinstein get that girl? Because he was rich and powerful. You know. So we can't. But I do think at a certain level, you have to have a level of clarity. You can't have, like, there are gradations of murder.
Yes. There's not just one murder.
Right, like, they're lumping them all together now.
Have you changed your behavior in light of Me Too?
I have not.
Even in terms of just, like, saying something if you see something?
I have not.
So, okay.
I can't think of a way I act now that I wouldn't have before.
Do you think that's cool?
I don't know. We'll know in a minute. Because I don't think there's anything that I'm doing that I wouldn't say I did.
But there are lots of folks saying it is this culture of, like, masculinity, period. So, like, if you're a man and you see another man doing something inappropriate, going into a place you shouldn't be doing, like, it is more on men everywhere to call that out.
If I saw a man before there was a Me Too, there was a me. I'm a man.
Yeah.
And there are certain things I would allow men to do around me.
Yeah.
And anybody who knows me and who's been in my, any woman who's been in my presence, know there are a lot of things you ain't going to be able to do around me. I don't think I ever needed a movement to do. So to your point, I don't act any differently because I believe the way I've done things is at least honorable enough where I can hold my head up. I'm not saying I should have a statue, but I ain't got to hang my head in shame for a lot of things I've done.
Pound for pound, do you think Me Too is good for the culture?
I think that it depends on what it gets, what it was. Look, the fruit it bears. Look at all the things they do to women of color. Are you going to include that in this too?
Mm-hmm.
Are you going? And then, you said that there's some. You're going back in time to make some things right. How far are you going to go back?
Yeah.
Are you going to give everybody justice delayed is justice denied? Are you going to be? Because that's a heavy load to all of a sudden make things right. Are you going to make it right only to a point where it's convenient for you? Yeah.
Well, I'm thinking about this week, R. Kelly in the news again.
I think
we've been new.
But we did. And you know what's so funny? And I talk about this all the time. If you make an album that's good enough, black people make excuses for you. I'll never buy Kanye West music again. I don't care what he says.
After the slavery comments.
I'll never do it. But if you make an album good enough, black people, well, you know he ain't been the same since his mama died.
A lot of white people, too.
Yeah. I'll tell you what. For me, I think that that black people, in my experience, have made a lot of excuses for people just because of the thing. Like, if you make us feel a way, evoke some emotion in us.
Michael Jackson,
O.J. Simpson, Bill Cosby. That's how bad we need to feel good. Much like society can make monsters, we can make our own heroes. We can tell our own stories. We can edify our own positions and not hold people to account.
Yeah. Last question for you that I know you got to go.
Sure.
Tell me a joke. Tell me a joke from your special.
A joke from my special that I'm really excited. You know, it was very funny because I now that people are so interested in their DNA.
Yeah.
Like everybody that 23andMe,
which I've never been into because it's
neither.
Either way, I'm black.
That's right. Like
still can't get a cab in New York.
It's really weird to me for black people to be into this because only in America would they steal you from your homeland and sell your ancestry back to you. Like
make you pay for it to know.
For $100, I'll show you where we stole you from. Like, and you ever notice how excited white people are when they find they got a little black? Oh, I'm 3% black. Well, you're not going to report.
But you wouldn't take 75%, would you?
No, you're not going to report that to Equifax, are you? Because I want to be black, but I just apply for a home loan. It's called contrarian. I'm very excited. You know, one thing I will say, okay. I think between the radio show and the book and the special contrarian, I found myself in probably the most creative space I've ever been in.
I like that.
And it's been so... this is how selfish it is. I said, I just want my old man to live long enough so he could see I had another book on the New York Times bestseller.
Yeah.
That was my...
And you've had a few now, right?
Because, yeah, so I wanted to walk in with him and say, this. I wrote this, and you're in the book, and I talked about it, and it just has been such a creative space, and I've never felt clearer, which is the closest approximation as I can come to happiness.
I like that.
I like it, too.
I really appreciate it. The book is called How Not to Get Shot. The Netflix special is coming out.
In September. It's called Contrarian.
Contrarian. Thank you.
Thank you, man.
I'm a lifetime fan.
Thank you, man. What a pleasure.
Many thanks to D.L. Hughley. His new book is called How Not to Get Shot and Other Advice from White People. Also want to thank some other people today. Everyone who came out to our live show in Los Angeles last night, Monday night. It was super fun. I always enjoy seeing y'all real live in the flesh. It's great. If you missed that show, we'll have many more shows to come. Actually, one more in the L.A. area later this year around October. Stay tuned. Also, as always, make sure to send me the best thing that happened to you this week or any week or all the weeks. Record yourself. Send the file to me at samsanders@npr.org. samsanders@npr.org. Until Friday, thank you for listening. Talk soon.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Sell without needing to code or design. Just bring your best ideas and Shopify will help you open up shop. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/NPR.
This message is brought to you by NPR sponsor, Lisa, in collaboration with West Elm. Discover the new natural hybrid mattress, expertly crafted from natural latex and certified safe foams, designed with your health and the planet in mind. Visit leesa.com to learn more. This message comes from The Run Through with Vogue. Listen as designers, Vogue editors, and industry icons like Erykah Badu and Florence Pugh have in-depth conversations about fashion and culture. New episodes are released each Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.